Radio EcoShock.
Has climate change hurt your mental health? Susie Burke is with the Australian Psychological Society. She's made a specialty of studying the impacts of climate change on mental health. Susie, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
What is your position with the Australian Psychological Society?
I'm a senior psychologist in a team called the Public Interest Team. So we take an interest in how psychology can contribute to community wellbeing. But I've specialised over the last few years in environmental issues and in natural disasters, well, all sorts of disasters, but particularly natural disasters because of the nexus that they have with climate change and environmental issues.
And you've had plenty in Australia, and we will talk about that. I wanted to say I first found you in an article titled A Climate of Despair in the Sydney Morning Herald newspaper. And it begins with an environmental scientist with a developing case of depression about the future. And I would think climate scientists are on the front lines, maybe encountering, if I could call it, pre-traumatic stress disorder. Are psychologists finding more people having difficulty imagining a positive future?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I'll just take a step back for a moment to say that we don't actually have much hard evidence, empirical research into rates of, depression or traumatic stress conditions amongst people who might be working on climate. It's much more anecdotal at the moment. But it's also a no-brainer. If you think of all the thousands of people that are working around the world on environmental issues or working in climate campaigning, to imagine that there are considerable degrees of distress and stress and anxiety and unhappiness amongst those people, particularly when you're working in a political climate like we have in Australia at the moment and like you have in Canada, where the politics almost seems to be at odds with the climate movement and, working against them, not working on common goals.
Yeah, we're driving the wrong way down a dangerous one-way street, and it is distressing to see that. What do you think happened to the Greens after the failure of the 2009 Copenhagen climate talks?
Well, I think there's always two things that happen after talks have been disappointing or when there are giant setbacks. And one is a huge sense of, deflation and pessimism and falling in a bit of a slump and feeling pessimistic and unhappy about the future. But I think then what happens amongst groups that are working well is that they rally and they pull themselves back together again and they optimistically, sort of lick their wounds and get back out there and keep working because for two reasons. One being giving up and go to bed and pulling the blankets over your head doesn't solve the problem that you care deeply about. So really one has no choice if one is working in that field but to pick oneself up and keep going. And secondly, working in a community of people who are all fighting for the same cause and for a cause that has great meaning because it is about the well-being of the beautiful planet that we live in, but also the well-being for, future generations, for our children, for our grandchildren. So we're all highly motivated. But the experience of working together with other people in the climate movement is in itself empowering and supportive and keeps people going. So I think the two things happen. I think there's an initial, a deep sighing out and a sense of hopelessness and helplessness, and then a pulling together and using each other's enthusiasm and encouragement to keep going because you can't not.
I worry, Susie, that if someone comes to a psychologist or a psychiatrist saying climate change is going to wipe out our future and they're really down about that, that they might be diagnosed with a mental problem and offered a drug prescription. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. Oh, I don't think that would happen. I think what would be much more likely to happen, well, let me answer this in two ways. One is that often, people who are more susceptible to being so distressed about a world issue to the point of despair are people who might have a vulnerability to feeling anxious about things or to feel things deeply. So it would be unlikely that one would leap to medication for something like that. A more useful response, I guess, would be to acknowledge the deep distress and to share it and then to look for ways of a person being able to manage that, which would be always threefold. One would be, you know, taking care of your own mental health using your own strategies. Many people already are well practiced in, which is about spending time with friends and families that you care about and doing positive things and getting a sense of mastery, so doing things that help you feel like that you're accomplishing something. And then the second part of that would be orienting people towards a group of people who feel similarly and who are doing positive things about it. And the third being the doing positive things about it. So actually taking action to deal with the problem itself. So we often talk in psychology about emotion-focused coping and problem-focused coping. And so in this situation where you're describing somebody deeply despondent about environmental issues, you'd work on both levels. So the emotion-focused coping is about helping them to recognize how to help them to manage their emotions, so to use psychological strategies to do that. And the other would be the problem-focused coping, which is to find groups to amplify your effect by working together with other people and to keep your motivation going and to be tackling the problem by being an activist, writing letters to your politicians, campaigning, marching, planting trees, you know. And I guess another one, which I haven't mentioned yet, would be also spending time in nature. There's a lot of research that comes out of psychology around psychological restoration that comes from being in nature. And for many people, time spent in nature is a source of psychological restoration. So there's something about different natural landscapes that are soothing and restore our mental capacities and also our emotional well-being.
I've experienced that myself. Now, Susie Burke, is there a term for climate distress now?
Well, there's a few terms that have been coined over the years. So one that was coined by an Australian philosopher, Glenn Albrecht, solastalgia, has received a bit of notice. Solastalgia is the loss that people feel when the familiar markers of their environment are lost or displaced. So that might be the experience that Indigenous people might feel when they, or maybe when they get moved from their homelands, or when they notice the rivers drying up and the landscape that they're dependent on changing in a permanent or more permanent way. So there's that term, solastalgia, and then there are other terms like eco-anxiety and terms like that.
I've talked with a psychologist in the United States, Carolyn Baker, and she's leading a movement to help people grieve now for the future. What do you think of that?
It sounds fairly similar to a group of psychologists here in Australia who are helping people to deal with the grief and the loss that engaging on climate issues brings up as a first step towards then being able to take action. So I guess ultimately what we're wanting everybody to do is to move on to a place of hopefulness and action, because we just can't afford not to. And so I think it's a terrific idea to be working with groups of people to get them to acknowledge and grieve the losses of what has been lost and what will be lost, because often that's an important prerequisite to being able to face it. You have to be able to really feel the loss to fully accept that this is the reality, and therefore to accept the urgency. And really what we are looking at is a wholesale change in the very way in which we live. All that we have come to depend on, this abundance of fossil fuel benefits, we can't rely on or depend on or take as our birthright any longer. And so the very affluence that has come from an abundance of cheap fossil fuels is not going to be available to us anymore. So there is an enormous amount of change that is required. So another part of this work as well that a psychologist or anybody might be engaging in is also then moving on to valuing what remains and celebrating a low-carbon future, if you want, and seeing that that has got great value in it as well. And if a great carbon future means more sharing of resources, then what that means is more, what that can mean in our communities is more time spent with neighbours, more cooperative values, more sharing at a personal level. It might mean a more active lifestyle, which you know, I think we would all agree would be beneficial for our health. And there is, of course, a lot of research to show that as well, that relying less on fossil fuels to drive yourself around and being more human-powered is ultimately really good for our health.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking about climate change and mental health with our guest, Susie Burke from the Australian Psychological Society. Susie, I know that Australia is a place of many wonders. You've had some of the worst bushfires on Earth, some of the biggest floods and droughts, some of the world's biggest climate deniers, possibly including the current Prime Minister. I wonder if the appearance of climate change causes a kind of split in the country.
I'd be inclined to dismiss that as important for one main reason, being that given the size of the problem and the urgency of us all getting together, I think dwelling on splits of opinion and belief are not ultimately helpful. And I'll explain what I mean by that. One thing that we know from the research that's been done on Australians and North American and UK citizens' beliefs about climate change is that a relatively very small proportion of our populations in those three regions are actually true climate deniers. So really only about 5 to 6 to 7% of people are truly denying or sceptical about the science. I don't believe that our Prime Minister is sceptical about the science. I think he does accept the science on climate change. I think his policies are not reflecting the urgency with which you need to make changes, and that is an enormous problem. But one of the dangers that we have in the way in which climate change has been discussed in the recent past in our countries is to portray it as though there is much more of a split in people's minds about whether this is a real problem or not. And I think it's much more helpful for us to recognise and live out the knowledge that actually the vast, vast majority of citizens do accept climate change. We know that 97.1% of climate scientists accept human-caused climate change. And instead, to see that we do share a concern about climate change, and that there is unity around that, because I do really believe that the research shows us that that is the case.
Well, as we've talked about, in both Canada and Australia, our governments seem to be taking us towards more carbon rather than less. And it must be very hard on the people who are trying to do something about climate change to see us going in that wrong direction. How do people handle that despair?
Yeah, I agree. I think it must be very hard when you're seeing policies that have been established, like for us, our price on carbon undone. I think that what happens is the climate action groups, environment groups, and, you know, I'm sort of very familiar with the actions of a lot of them. I think they quickly regroup and they fine-tune and they rely and try to build their support base from the community even more. And I think the reality is here, and most likely in Canada as well, that the public, the community, the grassroots communities are very concerned. And in some ways, when policy drifts far too far, it empowers the community to get out on the streets even more. And one of the things that I've noticed in the focus in our climate movement here, and I know that it's happening in the States as well, and possibly Canada too, is this big emphasis on divestment, and so trying to get individuals to divest, pull their money out from funding fossil fuels, new fossil fuel investments, and in so doing, trying to make that be an immoral thing to do, and to take away the social license in our country and, you know, in your country from fossil fuels being a viable way of powering our communities, and so doing, breaking the stranglehold that the fossil fuel industry has on our politics, and most likely yours as well. And so I've noticed a shift in, it may just be my observation, but I have become aware of that shift where they're trying to get the grassroots to take away the social license, to make that immoral to be polluting the planet.
Yeah, take your money out and don't pay for climate disaster. Now, suppose we watch the latest climate disaster on TV, possibly made worse by climate change, you know, and it may be a flood or a drought with lives lost and many more lives affected, perhaps in Pakistan. Can this bad news from far away affect our own mental health?
So you're talking now about vicarious distress, aren't you? What's it like to watch the latest extreme weather event or disaster, natural disaster in another part of the world, and how do we feel about that? And I think that because of the news media and the greater accessibility we have to all those images, I think it can be very distressing. Often when I'm talking with people about the mental health impacts or the psychosocial impacts of climate change, the vicarious distress about what happens to other people in other parts of the world is one discrete category that I talk quite a bit about. What's interesting, I think, though, in the social science research around how we get people to engage with climate change is that whilst we might feel distress for those vicarious exposure to disasters in other parts of the world that we understand have been exacerbated by, you know, changing climate, what we're much more motivated to take action on are climate impacts that we see as being here and now. And so I understand that you've also interviewed George Marshall, who's been working on, you know, can we talk about climate change now in relation to floods in UK? And that's a very interesting area of inquiry and climate activism, if you want, to use the proximity of an event, of an extreme weather event in one's own home to highlight the risks of climate change for us now and in the future. And, of course, that's something that we can do very readily in Australia because, as you said before, we are very exposed to extreme weather events of all types all around the country. And there are many, many Australians who are living in places that are vulnerable to bushfires, floods or cyclones. And so helping them, and what we do know is that disasters are likely to be more frequent and more intense under a more unstable climate, and therefore the imperative is for communities to get better at preparing themselves for them. And in getting communities to prepare themselves for it, that's adaptation to climate change, if you understand climate change to be a slowly evolving natural disaster, which I think is a very useful way of thinking about it.
Right. Well, along those lines, what is the Psychological Preparedness Guide and where can people find it?
We've got some psychological preparedness materials on our APS website, which is psychology.org.au. And we take a three-pronged approach to psychological preparedness. So we talk about psychological preparedness being as important as household preparedness. So the household preparedness might be the, you know, cleaning up your yard in the case of a cyclone, tying things down, getting all your leaf litter away from around your house if you're in a bushfire zone, all the sorts of things that you do to physically prepare your house. And then the psychological preparedness goes hand in hand with that, because what we know is that when people are in a stressful situation and their arousal goes up and they feel anxious and frightened, they're less likely to be able to think clearly and they may be less likely to follow their plan. And so we work with people to help them do three things: to anticipate what it's going to be like when they're in a disaster warning situation or when a disaster comes. So we've got the situation in Australia where, you know, we have cyclones and they'll be coming for days often. And so people in those communities, coastal communities, will often be on a high alert for a number of days. That can be a very stressful situation itself. The same with the bushfires. A bushfire might be in the region and depending on the winds and the weather, it might come or it might not come. So people have got quite a lot of time to anticipate them sometimes. So anticipating is imagining, what's it going to feel like? What am I going to be thinking? How might I react? And you do all of this before you're in that situation. Then the next step is I, AIM. We call it AIM. So the next step is I, identify. So we teach people to identify in their bodies, how do I know that I'm feeling scared. How do I, what's my body doing? You know, sweaty palms, short of breath, racing thoughts. These are all signs of anxiety. So we teach people to recognize signs of anxiety so they can go, oh, I'm feeling anxious. Right, now I'm going to need to manage this. So the third step is manage. So we teach people how to reduce their anxiety. And you're never going to be able to get rid of all your anxiety if a bushfire's coming or the floodwaters are rising, and we don't necessarily want that because that can sort of tighten up all your reactions. But we don't want people's anxiety to be so high that they sort of are unable to stick to their plan and follow their plan. And so we teach people to reduce that anxiety, and we do that in two ways. One would be teaching people to breathe out slowly, to slow down the out-breath, and that's a very tried and proven way of reducing anxiety. And we get people to practice self-talk, to say things to themselves like, I can cope, I have a plan, I've thought this through and I know what to do, soothing, sort of empowering things to say to yourself. So those are the three steps: anticipate, identify, and manage.
It reminds me of the saying, stay calm and carry on, which they had in World War II.
Yeah.
You've released tip sheets on how to cope with knowing about climate change and still carry on with life. Do you have time to just share one or two of those tips with our listeners?
Yeah. Well, I think that the three most important things are to be honest, be emotionally honest. So to acknowledge and to speak about what it's like to know about climate change and to care about it and to feel bad about it and to share that with people. Because that makes it real. It makes it real for you, and it helps other people to listen to that and to understand that they might also be feeling similarly and that they were dealing with it perhaps by just denying it or not thinking too much about, not denying the science, but, you know, dismissing, minimizing the problem, distracting themselves with, you know, whatever they're going to have to dinner or their latest boyfriend or girlfriend or whatever. So that's a really important thing, is to acknowledge the feelings of dismay and distress and guilt and shame and anger and all of that, and to speak them and to talk about them. And the second would be to associate with people who care similarly and who are doing something about it, because we're so empowered and supported by being in groups. A whole lot of things flourish when we work in groups. And the third would be to use that energy of the group and of your own caring so deeply about things to do something about it. And that's that problem-focused coping. So to be divesting your money and writing letters to the banks and writing letters to the premier and the, you know, your elected representatives and campaigning and, you know, doing everything that you can at all levels. We know how to tackle climate change. There's plenty to do. We know it.
Buy a bike, I say.
Buy a bike.
Is there anything that I've missed that you'd like to say as we wrap up here?
Oh, we've covered a lot, Alex. I've talked endlessly. Thank you.
Well, you've had some great tips. I know our listeners are going to enjoy that. We've been talking with Susie Burke, senior psychologist at the Australian Psychological Society. Susie, thank you for your help and for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much, Alex.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.